Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 49, all right, at the beginning, which is old single column page 559. All right, so this starts a new block of papers. We've been working our, you know, in part two here, we've been working our way down from the local universe headquarters level, down through the hierarchy of local universes. We finally have made it down where the rubber meets the road, down to the trenches in which we are born, down to the level of nativity spheres, the so-called inhabited worlds of the universe of universes. So the first paper is just that, the inhabited worlds. And we're definitely shifting gears here quite a bit relative to where we were at the end of that previous block when we were dealing with the local system level proper. But you know, remember that even though we have, you know, effectively dropped down, we haven't dropped down, you know, literally to another level. There aren't four levels per se in a local universe. There's just three. The inhabited worlds are part of the local system. They're what the administrators at the local system headquarters are administering, those inhabited worlds. So, you know, we are still technically, you know, at the local system level in the greater sense of that. But we are definitely not talking about, you know, the issues of, you know, of administration from on high anymore. We're not talking about issues like the system sovereign, who in the very early stages of a world functions for all intents and purposes as the idea of God for those early peoples. You know, we are down at nothing that can be remotely thought of as heaven or the gods. We are down on earth now. Yeah, remember how we had the talking about the heavens and the heavens of heavens and the first heaven and all those various ideas. You know, in no way, shape, or form are we at that mode anymore. We're down where it all begins, where the lowest level of personalized selves are brought into existence. And in the process, we'll get a little bit about the animal origin nature of those evolutionary beings that, like us. But just, you know, a little in passing for the context of it. Mainly, we're going to, you know, get a better sense of the diversity of beings on inhabited worlds. You know, until we had the fifth epical revelation, you know, lots of science fiction writers have speculated all over the place. You know, the revelation is the authoritative elimination of error in that domain. All of the wild speculations that science fiction authors have done is, you know, we'll see as, you know, those speculations are not valid. But to have only experienced one world's human race is to have a distinct bias about just how diverse beings like us can be made, can be designed by the life carriers.
You would be more interested in the planet
comet? Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah, we'll get to that in a little bit. you know, it definitely is very intriguing what they give us here. The fact that they were allowed to reveal quite a bit of facts. You might say more precisely disclose, right? I mean, you reveal truth and you disclose facts, to be precise. But in the context of the revelation, we're given a lot of facts about this diversity, about what you can expect If you go on a field trip, when you're up there as an ascender, and you can go out and check out other worlds, what kind of diversity is out there? All right, so let's just get started here.
Paper 49, the inhabited worlds. All mortal inhabited worlds are evolutionary in origin and nature. These spheres are the spawning ground, the evolutionary cradle of the mortal races of time and space. Each unit of the ascendant life is a veritable training school for the stage of existence just ahead. And this is true of every stage of man's progressive paradise ascent. Just as true of the initial mortal experience on an evolutionary planet as of the final universe headquarters school of the Melchizedeks, a school which is not attended by ascending mortals until just before the transition to the regime of the super universe and the attainment of first stage spirit existence.
Okay, so now let's think about that. It's an interesting way to start you out. Before giving you any of the details, like I was just talking about, they give you that little preface. Yeah, notice the key element there, that each unit of the ascendant life, so we've been talking about, we have this whole hierarchy we've been coming down through, and every level in that hierarchy that you are initially ascending up through, each unit of the ascendant life is a veritable training school for the stage of existence just ahead. The first thing they want you to know, that no matter how much diversity there is, the truth of your existence here is that this is a training school for the first mansion world. And the first mansion world is a training school for the second mansion world. Right? No world is an end. Every world is a beginning. You're not ascending to some end. There is no end. You're heading towards eternity. There is no end. You're heading into an endless sequence of beginnings. Yeah, to see your life here, the great truth of your life here, is it's a beginning. Why do you get frustrated about this life? Because you think that it should be an ending in some way. You know, you'd like to dot every I and cross every T in some area. You'd like something to be completed, to be perfect, to be finished, to stay eternally, and when you're gone or whatever, right? Just think about how that's the source of it. Most of the tension that humans feel in this life. See, so the very first thing they tell you is that. And stop thinking about it that way. That's not true. Right? Yeah, you'll live forever on this world looking for something on this world to be an ending. There are no endings on this world. It's the beginning of beginnings. So just let it be just that. Merely that. Just a beginning. Don't put false expectations on your life here. Just let it be a humble little tadpole beginning world.
Yeah. But at every turn, from the cradle straight through, we are told this. And we see it all around us. Dead birds, dogs in the streets, it's the ending, we're told. We're programmed from infancy.
Yeah, okay, I mean, bringing in that point, for those in the webinar, he's talking about, how people are always saying, it's the end of times in some way or another. Why does that kind of doctrine invariably crop up? I mean, if you fundamentally think there should be some, finality, some endingness, in this life, as soon as you have a religious consciousness of the most primitive sort, that's the kind of doctrine that's inescapably is going to be part of your thinking. You're going to think that's what religion is all about, telling you how it is that this world is going to be an ending, or how it is that you live in the end times, or whatever. See, again, it's just because of that bias. Religion, true religion, won't have any sort of stories any sort of end time stories, any sort. Well, I mean, there was those stories long before there was the Book of Revelations. You know, that's just 2,000 years old. Long before, you know, there was a Bible. You know, when Anagar first got religion going, almost a million years ago, these stories began. Right? You know, like the Revelators point out in the evolution of religion. I mean, it's one of the oldest stories in the religious books. Right, or in the religious tales, is that somehow that's what should really animate you in your religious life, that there's some sort of finality that the fiat father is going to inject into this world.
Or else.
It's like, no. The fiat father is on the outside. The God of evolution is on the inside. And evolution is a process where every next stage is built upon the previous stage, like they're just saying, right? You're not going to, in some sort of just simple religious sense, or purely spiritual sense, ascend, through the universe. You're going to evolve up through the universe. It's an evolutionary thing. Your ascension is an evolution. It's not... some sort of religious phenomenon where the fiat God is reaching down and exalting you, right? You're not being lifted, literally, up to the Isle of Paradise. You are evolving up to the Isle of Paradise. Now, that's a very different thing about the fifth epical revelation. You know, changing that whole, the whole context of religious thought like that. Okay, so... So, before they talk about the facts, they give you that very foundational truth about inhabited worlds. There's a truth that flows through every world, no matter at what level. So it flows through this lowest world just as definitively as it flows through the highest world. Paradise is just what they're saying. It's just a veritable training school for the stage of existence just ahead. I mean... Paradise is where you learn what you're gonna, what you need to know to do the next thing. You know, even getting to paradise is not an end. I mean, technically, in the full sense, when you finally get to paradise, okay, now you have finally begun, right? Right? You're getting higher and higher levels as you ascend of beginningness, right? And you finally get to the top of beginningness. Right? That's what the Isle of Paradise is. The apex of beginningness. Like the Revelators tell you about being a final, becoming a finaliter on the Isle of Paradise. It's like, finaliter, wow, sounds very complete. No, you're the definition of incompleteness. Okay? You're perfect, but you're profoundly incomplete. Right? It's the beginning, towards completion, not the ending. All right, so now, yes. Yeah, oh, you got something? Yeah.
Yeah, I just have a paragraph there where it says paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Is paradise always capitalized throughout the book, regardless of where it's at?
Right, because when they just say paradise like that, the capital P, it's short for the Isle of Paradise, okay. Or the Paradise Isle. Right?
Thank you.
Yeah, so it's a place. All right.
All inhabited worlds are basically grouped for celestial administration into the local systems. And each of these local systems is limited to about 1,000 evolutionary worlds. This limitation is by the decree of the Ancients of Days, and it pertains to actual evolutionary planets, whereon mortals of survival status are living. Neither worlds finally settled in light and life, nor planets in the pre-human stage of life development, are reckoned in this group.
Okay, so now another little introductory statement. In the wake of what I was just saying, we just read about the administrative level of the local system in the previous block of papers. So they're bringing that up. Okay, what about that administrative aspect of the local system? Okay, you could easily get off on a false tangent in thinking about that last sentence. Okay. If you take it out of that paragraph, The paragraph, you know, sets the stage at the beginning of the paragraph. It's about administration, right? From Gerasim and the surrounding worlds. So in a very early stage, before Gerasim sends a planetary prince to an inhabited world, that's what they're talking about in the second part there. Nor planets in the pre-human stage of life development are reckoned in this group. Shortly after, on a normal world, shortly after you get the first humans, a planetary prince is sent, and that administration from the local system headquarters begins on that inhabited world. But before that, you know, it's in the hands of the life carriers. It's really more in the context of the local universe, sort of the foundations of the local universe. It's not immediately under administration of the local system headquarters, which is what they mean by that. And then the other thing, you know, neither world finally settled in light and life. Okay. So it's not like suddenly those aren't counted as an inhabited world or something. That's not what they mean. Or right, they just mean that once you get very settled in light and life, again, you know, you are... The whole administration in the local universe is evolving too. First, the whole local system is settled in the light and life, and then a whole constellation, then the whole local universe. You know, we'll read about that in a few papers hence. Things begin to change. You know, that world starts to be involved in the bigger picture. It's not so much immediately under the supervision of the local system headquarters, of the system sovereign. I mean, you know that for one reason, because you know most of the people on that world are totally skipping the whole local system. They're skipping the whole constellation level. You know, they're dying and being resurrected, or fusing and being resurrected clear up at the local universe headquarters. Right? See, so obviously it's not really under, you know, the administration. So that's what they mean. See, in those, so in the beginnings and ends, but everywhere in between, it's very much a world that has a planetary prince who's immediately under the supervision of the system sovereign, you know, and that this integrity of the system sovereign leads to integrity of planetary princes. If a planetary prince, you know, turns his eye away from that oversight, you know, he goes, you know, go off on a tangent. Of course, it's problematic if the system sovereign, like ours, you know, goes off on a tangent and takes a whole bunch of planetary princes with him. But okay, so that's what they're talking about. Don't, you know, misinterpret that that passage. It's just about that issue of the administration from the local system headquarters. Okay, so those are the two things. See, they give you the truth, and then they kind of just remind you of how what they're about to talk about here immediately ties back to what we were just reading about local system administration.
So okay. What about the pre-human stage? Who's watching them?
Yeah, like I said, the life carriers. The life carriers are in charge of the world. Right? And the life carriers really aren't under the immediate supervision of the system sovereign. You know, they're functioning more, like I said, as a local universe phenomenon. They're attuning the life, as we're about to read. They attune the life to the local system and everything. Right? But it's not like their immediate supervisor is the system sovereign, like the planetary prince's immediate supervisor is the system sovereign. Yeah, that's what they're getting at there. Okay, now let's get some facts.
Satania itself is an unfinished system containing only 619 inhabited worlds. Such planets are numbered serially in accordance with the registration as inhabited worlds, as worlds inhabited by willed creatures. Thus was Urantia given the number 606 of Satania, meaning the 606th world in this local system on which the long evolutionary life process culminated in the appearance of human beings. There are 36 uninhabited planets nearing the life endowment stage, and several are now being made ready for the life carriers. There are nearly 200 spheres which are evolving so as to be ready for life implantation within the next few million years.
Okay, so this whole bit about the numbering, like they said in the previous paragraph, you know, you may have forgotten that little detail, that by the decree of the Ancients of Days, right, you have some number around 1,000, you know, of inhabited worlds that are going to be spun up in each local system. And remember how that all works. It all ties back to the pattern universe. And, you know, this local system ties back to a certain one of the billion worlds in the central universe. And so that variation in how many inhabited worlds has to do with this local system evolving to fit that specific pattern of that world in the central universe. And the Ancients of Days know the big picture, right? And you know, say there's going to be, you know, 982 or whatever, or 1,019 or whatever heck they say for a particular local system. And we're chugging along towards whatever our final number is, somewhere around 1,000. And we're up to 619 now. We're 606. And again, in that previous statement about neither world's finally settled in light and life, it's not like a world when it gets, like when this world is deeply settled in light and life, we won't be 606 of Satani anymore. It's not that, that's not what they're saying. We'll always be the 606th world, you know, that was initiated here. It's just that we won't be so immediately under, you know, that local administration. Remember, when you get really deeply settled in light and life, you've got the finaliters and the unqualified supervisors of the supreme, I mean, you know, stuff in play. I mean, you're starting to have the supreme being from the absonite domain, you know, engaging and bringing some rule to the world via his deputies, via the unqualified supervisors of the supreme. So, you know, things are way above the level of system sovereigns, you know, at that point, obviously. Okay. But this is the second half of this paragraph is a really key one. This is where you know they're giving you this little hint about apparently the way this works in terms of spinning up worlds. That they don't just say, you know, let's say we're supposed to have 1,019. They don't just spin up 1,019 all at the same time. They're done in blocks. And apparently they're done in blocks of about 200. Right? So that we've had three blocks spun up so far. You know, we have about 600. And they've got the next 200 in the works. And it's a long time between those worlds being quote-unquote inhabited worlds. See, they're giving you the definition of that. Worlds inhabited by will creatures. Okay, it's because they're inhabited by cephalopods doesn't mean they're an inhabited world. Right? They mean inhabited by will creatures.
What's a cephalopod?
Well, like, you know, any sort of animal, like octopi or... Right, you know, or if it's inhabited by trilobites, or right, or fishes, or ferns, or right. No, it needs to be will creatures. Okay, so we're moving towards that, and we've got this next block that's being spun up, and they tell you out of those roughly 200. You've got 36 of them that are getting really close now to what? You know, what is it they say there? Do you understand what they're speaking about? You know, nearing the life endowment stage. You know, nearing that time when the life carriers are going to implant the first eukaryotic cells. Right? I mean, especially those 36 may already have prokaryotic life, you know, there, getting an atmosphere developed, terraforming the world and stuff, but not eukaryotic life, not the first single-celled plants. You know? So think about that. Even the leading edge of this next 200, they're almost to the point that we were how long ago? Anyone remember from part three? 550 million years ago. Right? Right. So, you know, if evolution goes on those worlds, you know, about like it did here, I mean, we'll be 550 million years in the future on this planet before they even have the first will creatures on those worlds, on any of those 200. Right? How far into the light and life will we be You know, before they even have their quote-unquote and an infanta, you know, before they have their first two will creatures. So remember how we mentioned that when you're thinking about how many people are going up through the mansion worlds, right? Those other, you know, 400 worlds that were before us, before our block of 200, you know, have been in light and life for a very, very long time. Right? None of them are going through the mansion world, right? You know, and if if there's ones in our block that got going or got to will creatures, you know, quicker than we did or whatever, you know, they may be already skipping over the mansion worlds too. Even ones in our block of 200, right? So, you know, it's not like you've got 619 worlds teeming with life all trying to get onto the first mansion world. No, you've got just a subset. And see, that's the main thing. The mansion worlds can't handle 1,000 worlds with, you know, billions and billions of people all trying to get onto the first mansion world. The first mansion world is only the size of our planet. Right? So, right, they have to manage this. There's logistics. They take little blocks. They're spread out. I mean, if only 36 are kind of getting kind of close to that life implantation, I mean, you know, the rest of the 200, there may be some, you know, they say that, you know, they're ready for life implantation within the next few million years.
Yeah,
right?
It makes you right. Wonder, why do they want to keep implanting life? I mean, don't they have enough variations of humans?
No.
You know?
No. See, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, that's what we're about to study, is try to get a, you know, about a feel for how little imagination we have about this.
Yeah.
How big the Supreme is. How many variables are in play. How many different, you know, types of worlds there could be. Right? Remember, you're pushing towards how many inhabited worlds when all is said and done? And remember?
100 million?
Uh-huh.
7 trillion or 700 trillion?
Yeah, 7. I mean, a trillion in each,
right.
You know, super universe.
Oh, you're talking about the bigger picture.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's a lot of worlds, right? And the life on each one of those worlds is distinct. Right. That's how much variability there is. You know, we are only a very tiny part of the Supreme, of the big picture.
Yeah. So 700 trillion.
No, 7 trillion.
7 trillion.
Trillion in each super.
Wait a minute. It's got to be more than that.
A trillion inhabited worlds? Do you know how big a trillion is?
We're 19 trillion in debt.
Well, that's just a little reminder about how we don't have a monetary system anymore. Right. Right. So it's a very huge number, very incomprehensible. Okay, but see, so that's the key, the fact that they tell you that, you know, just think about, you know, the next few million years. I mean, do you think like that? Have you taken the tension out of your life with just that one sentence, right? That you won't even have the first single-cell plants on some nearby worlds until several million years from now? Right, and you're wanting to know why we don't have the consummator of universe destiny standing, you know, on your street corner, ready to complete everything. Right, I mean, we are so far from anything yet. Right, think about how far settled in light life will be before there's even the first single-celled plant on those worlds, and that'll only get us up to about 800. We still have another 200 to go after that. In this, just this one local system, right? And then there's local systems that haven't even gotten started yet.
So then there's the oddball planets like this that have so many variations. It's
right. So see, they're trying.
What?
It's a decimal planet every time.
I know, but what are you saying?
That variations of everything. You know, yeah. It's a very, very variable world.
So you think we're a lot different than.
Right, you know, we're abnormal. Yes, yes, we are we're an abnormal world. But just focus on this. You know, this reading this paper, and all you do is remember the percentage of super breathers, you know, relative to the percentage of sub breathers. You know, you've wasted your time reading this paper, right? I'm trying to get you to get in the mode of recognizing how even the humblest sentence about statements of fact should radically transform your life, should significantly take you one step closer to peace that passes all understanding. You need to master your spiritual consciousness by eternalizing your consciousness, right? Bringing in some patience about this life. You know, stop looking for the next political figure to, you know, give us light and life or some ridiculous thought like that that you may have in your head, right? It's a very long, slow process where it won't be until millions of years from now that it gets started, and then several hundred million years after that, they'll have the first two humans, and then, you know, and then there's all the dispensations, and, you know, that one's 500,000 years long, and that one's 50,000 years long, and on, you know, this is a very long-term process, right? Okay, so just live with that truth, you know, start to live your life knowing that this is just a beginning, like they said in the first paragraph, very, very beginnings of beginnings. Yeah, so be humble and patient in your life. And don't fill your head with false expectations of fiat completion.
Yeah. Of course, the extraordinary thing is once the grand universe is even in light and life, but that far distant trillions, then, of course, the other...
Yeah. Again, in the bigger picture, the whole grand universe is just what? It's just a veritable training school for the stage of existence just ahead,
exactly.
Right? And you complete millions of galaxies and stuff in the first outer space level, but that's just a veritable training school for the stage of existence, right? And on and on and on it goes.
So it makes you wonder when the life carriers, you know, did us, and they left that bacteria and stuff, and they were hoping that Adam and Eve would uplift us where we wouldn't be sick and we wouldn't get all those germs and stuff. So that the life carriers learned a big lesson just from us. You know, I wonder how many other planets
they didn't screw up, because the greatest affliction of the cosmos
is never to have been afflicted.
We just read that. So why are you complaining when you get sick? Why do you complain when you get sick? Why do you complain about bacteria and viruses? Do you not take to heart point number 12? Do you not think this is a revelation? Do you think it's not worth considering, not living your life by? No. The whole point is affliction. Stop complaining about affliction. That's the whole point. It's a veritable training school. Affliction is an opportunity. You know, they're watching you. You get sick. You go, yep. Complaining again. Flunk. Right? You got an F on that test. So if you get an F on a test, guess what? You get another test. If you want to stop, you know, getting tested like that, pass one of them.
I'm sure we do pass them, Chris, every time we get well.
Pass a test.
Yeah, we pass it.
Right? You know. Right? But it's not about getting well. It doesn't matter if you live or die or anything. Death is irrelevant. Right? It's about the truth of your life, not the facts of your life. How do you choose to respond to an affliction? Do you just do what comes naturally, what the laws of mind energy would dictate? You know, a physical affliction produces a sorrowful state of mind, naturally. That's the way God made you. Is that perfect because God made you that way? No, not in the longer sense. It's a perfect beginning, full of affliction, right? And a negative response to it, that you now have an opportunity to choose to not be that negative response, right? Can you not be sorrowful when the stimulus would make you sorrowful naturally? Now, if all you do is respond to the environment the way you naturally respond, you're an animal. Humans respond in a different way than what's natural. Humans are artificial Humans are an art form. The universe is mind-made and personality-managed. That personality management starts with you, your mindful self. Are you managing it? Are you choosing its state of mind? Or are you just letting it be what comes naturally? And assuming that that somehow is appropriate.
Well, there are things that are appropriate. Sorrow for the loss of a child is very appropriate.
You know, it's very natural. It's very natural.
And then you get, you grow up and you get, you know, you start to manage it and you're okay again. But there are things that just pop on you that you have to
In this life, perforce you serve two masters, yes. But just recognizing that the whole point is to not just be what you are as a beginning, like we were just reading. The whole point is that it's a veritable training school for the stage of existence just ahead. Right? Now, if you believe that the next world is identical to this one, so that you don't have to try to learn anything here, you've already got what you need for every world from now to eternity. No. You're supposed to be learning something here. You're supposed to be improved because the next world demands you to be improved. You can't get by on the next world with what you have here naturally. You had to have supplied favorable conditions so that you are growing a little bit to be able to handle the challenges of the next world.
Yeah, that's why I look at our afflictions as that exact thing, that it gives us that experience that when we do go to the next world, we can use that experience to help other people or whatever the need be, that we've grown because we have that. You know, so I understand that totally.
And that's all I'm saying. It's just, I'm just reminding you of that, right? Because it's easy to forget. Your animal mind forgets that all the time. Your animal mind doesn't know that, right? Your animal mind wants to, you know, just collapse when it's assaulted, right? Your animal mind doesn't have spiritual strength. And there's nothing natural about spiritual strength. Spiritual strength has to be chosen. You have to choose to have spirit fibers giving your mind strength. You know, you weren't given them naturally, like Havona natives. Havona natives innately have, you know, profound spiritual strength. They didn't have to do anything for it. They just got it by fiat. Right? We don't get any by fiat. We have to choose to have it.
When it gets tough, the tough get growing.
Very good.
Okay. All right, so, it's fine for us to take these little diversions. Like I said, we're about to go into lots and lots and lots of facts. You know, and so we don't have to constantly give voice to the truth that's flowing through it. But remember, that's the point. Try to be in a reflective state as you're reading this, thinking about the greater truths. How does this change the way you live your life? You know, it's going to try to help you with your very parochial attitude about life. Right? Your tendency to think that the tiny little space that you're born into defines the nature of reality. No, it's the diversity is so vast, it's beyond your imagination. Right? You should be humble. All right.
Not all planets are suited to harbor mortal life. Small ones having a high rate of axial revolution are wholly unsuited for life habitats. In several of the physical systems of Satania, the planets revolving around the central sun are too large for habitation, their great mass occasioning oppressive gravity. Many of these enormous spheres have satellites, sometimes a half dozen or more, and these moons are often in size very near that of Urantia, so that they are almost ideal for habitation.
Okay, so another kind of big picture, that worlds can be too small, worlds can be too big. It can be issues of gravitation, you know, or it might be really small because it really contracted a lot, and the more it contracted, the faster it, you know, was rotating like a spinner, like a ice skater pulling in their arms, right? You know, and so its actual revolution is too high, or its gravity is too high or too low or whatever, right? So there are boundaries. They can't do anything with any world. And sometimes there may be no planets in a stellar system that can be terraformed or habitable. But some of the moons of some of those planets might be. Okay. So, you know, the extent to which a science fiction author might have thought of that idea of having an inhabited moon instead of, you know, an inhabited planet. See, there's some validity to that thought.
Could be non-breathers.
Okay.
Think of the climatic temperature fluctuation. Because if it's going around a large planet, mm-hmm. it would quite likely be quite a differential between when it's closer to the sun and far away from the sun.
And there's all right. There's all these various things, right? And yeah, and the life carriers, you know, have great leeway to modify life to deal with all kinds of differences and dynamic variations like that. You know, where things aren't so long-term consistent. You know, maybe on some worlds things are just constantly changing, and everyone thinks that that's normal on those worlds. You know, and they would think, man, wouldn't it be boring to live on a world where, you know, like for 3 months it was basically the same weather? You know, like on our boring world, right? You know, whereas in other words, like, you know, think it's just, you know, why would you ever, I mean, want seasons, you know, or whatever, just, you know, all the things that might vary from world to world. All right.
Think
if the gravity of this planet was 100 times what it is. If you weighed 100 times what you do, right? Could you lift your foot to walk? No, right? You'd have to have muscles that are, you know, completely impractical to even lift your foot to walk. I mean, you can't have a world that, you know, that has too high a gravity.
Gravity just comes and pushes you down.
It's just crushing, you know. It just, you know, you could never have, you know, in a world like that, you could never have something as low density and fluffy as this cup, right? It'd just get crushed, right? So everything would have to be made out of platinum or something, and, you know, it just impractical, right? Okay.
The oldest inhabited world of Satania, world number one, is Anova. One of the 44 satellites revolving around an enormous dark planet, but exposed to the differential light of 3 neighboring suns. Anova is in an advanced stage of progressive civilization.
Okay, so that's a curious little thing to just throw in there. And then and then coining this name for it, it's probably... you know, meant to be just pronounced A Nova, right? I mean, it's probably the Latin word Nova that means new, and then just a letter A in front of it, you know, like U major, U minor, U versa, right? Just the letter U there, you know, here it's probably just a letter A here. Okay, and so that coinage, what are they getting at? It's like, okay, so you have a new local system, right? You know, hence the Nova. So, you know, they're giving you a sense of, you know, if you were there, part of the local system administration, and you're starting up this, you know, the first inhabited world, you think, oh, we've got the first world in this new local system. Okay, and the letter A, you know, A is short for AN, you know, which just means the number one. You know, the article, A or an, you know, that word, you know, just means the number one, right? So, I mean, that's what they're getting at. You know, it literally means first, you know, it's the first in this new local system. Obviously, on that world, they don't call themselves, you know, A Nova any more than, you know, the name of our world in some general sense is Urantia, right? I mean, the name of that world is just as much Urantia as ours is. Right, that's their heavenly place, just like this is our heavenly place. Right, you know. So again, they're just coining it to give you a sense of, they were thinking, we're starting a new local system, and this is the first world. Okay. Now, this the comments they make should get your gears turning a little bit. It's like, wait a minute, an enormous dark planet, the differential light of three neighboring suns. Okay, so you may recall when we were back reading about the physical aspects of the local universe. This is back in paper 41. You don't have to turn to it if you want, but it's paper 41, section 2. It's on page 457. Do you remember how they were talking about how the Supreme Power Center for our local system is on a dark island, you know, close to Jerison, right? And, you know, so they made a few passing comments about that. And, you know, in that, see, what is that, the one, two, the third paragraph of section two there, they said that a master physical controller stationed on his on this headquarters sphere works in coordination with the system power center, serving as liaison chief of the power inspectors headquartered on Jerusalem and functioning throughout the local system. And see, so they're talking about, remember how, and we talked about that, how they, you know, you had this linkage, you know, between Jerusalem and the neighboring world. Okay, well, right before that, in the second paragraph, at the end there, they were mentioning that the Astronomic Center of Satania is an enormous dark island of space, which, with its attendant spheres, is situated not far from the headquarters of the system government. Okay? They used the adjective enormous there, enormous dark island, just like they did here. They said it was an enormous dark planet. And this is the only one they talk about as being enormous like this, where they specifically, you know, obviously a lot of them would be enormous, but curiously, this one is explicitly pointed out to be enormous. It's the only time that a dark island of space is literally said to be enormous. Right? You know, like I said, a lot of them might be, yeah. Of course. But this one, and what, you know, you may have forgotten back there when we were talking about this linkage between that dark island and Jerusalem, between the master physical controllers and the power center, and, you know, that they mentioned that dark island had attendant spheres. Right? Yeah. So here's one that's described as enormous, and it says that it has 44 satellites revolving around it. I bet you they're talking about the dark island that's right next to Jerusalem. So that the first inhabited world was just a stone's throw from the local system headquarters, one of those satellites of that dark island. Okay, and then what was the other thing that was said about this? You may remember back when they were when we were starting, what is that, paper 46, you know, this is on page 520 at the end of section 1 in that paper. Remember how they mentioned that Jerusalem receives faint light from several nearby suns, a sort of brilliant starlight, but it is not dependent on them? So, little stones are away. There's nearby suns. Okay, maybe for Jerusalem, they're just like brilliant starlight. But over there, right, nearby, it was described as nearby there. Here it says there's differential light of three neighboring suns. Neighboring, nearby. All right. So, you know, it seems to be all just between the lines here. Right, that this first inhabited world was just, you know, right there with an eyesight from Jerusalem. You know, you can see those three neighboring suns from Jerusalem with a naked eye, probably, right?
Do you think perhaps this dark island is so enormous that perhaps these suns are actually revolving around the dark island?
Well, this is what, you know, I was, you know, what you begin to think about. we don't know how much, I mean, there's obviously going to be a lot of control of the motions of objects, you know. You got a literal power center right there and stuff, okay? So it's all not just going to be sort of natural orbits and whatnot going on right there at the center of everything, that power center region. You know, so even if the suns aren't literally kind of in sort of, you know, Keplerian orbits, you know, about it, that dark island is definitely the gravity center, you know, and so they would naturally be, you know, located near it, no matter what kind of a path the master physical controllers might have these objects on and stuff, and they're controlling them. Right, the sort of the anchor for those star, that many stars to stay localized like that would be the Dark Island. Right, even if it isn't literally, you know, just a simple sort of an orbit situation. Right, but definitely, you know, that's the reason why, you know, back there, lost that page, back there where it says, you know, that there was several stars nearby, right? It's because of that Dark Island. Yep.
Maybe it's a silly question, but ANOVA, is in the advanced stage of progressive civilization. Now, is that an advanced stage? Life?
Okay, well,
not the first planet, it's got to be away.
Right, so I was just going to bring that up. So that last statement, that it's in an advanced stage of progressive civilization. So it would be part of those first 200, say,
right?
So how long ago, you know, would this planet have gotten to light and life? You know, probably well over a billion years ago at least.
Mm. Right? These early stages, so, they just don't make them automatically. Okay, you're light and life, you're done.
No, remember, there's seven stages of light and life, right? You know, but you know, so just, you know, like we were saying, you know, if it took us 550 million years to go from eukaryote, you know, the first eukaryotic plants to Annan and Fanta, right? Just, you know, that sort of time scale, right? I mean, if you got, you know, this is way back in that first block of planets. So just think about how far back that was. I mean, how deep in light and life those worlds would be. I mean, it's got to be at least a billion years ago. You know, I mean, they would have gotten to light and life before Michael even did his first bestowal.
But they don't stop being advanced in light and life. It's not like, okay, you're there, so now you're going into the...
Right, the seventh stage of light and life never ends until the grand universe ends.
Period.
Right? Right. But just, you know, just think about that world. I mean, so when you're on Gerasim, you could take a trip. You know, and you wonder, well, when would you be allowed to take such a trip to such an extremely advanced world? It's kind of an interesting question to ask. You know, and think about, you know, even when that world had its first humans. You know, if they had an adjuster and they had a soul, so they survived that life. I mean, think about what a quick trip it is. They die there on that world. They're resurrected in the first mansion world, which is just a stone's throw away. You can resurrect them on the third day instead of the third period, right? Because the transport time is, you know, is nothing, basically. You know, they're within eyesight.
So right? If it's 600, if we're world 606 and they're world 1, then you said you thought that they've been in existence for a billion years?
Well, no, I'm just saying that they probably, you know, let just be very conservative. Maybe they got to light and life a billion years ago. I mean, you know, it would have taken them a long time to get to light and life before that, too.
No, I'm talking about when they were formed. When were they?
Well, again, you can only guess. You can only guess, right? I mean, we don't know. Did it take them 550 million years to evolve humans? You know, I mean... You know, part of the reason why it took us a long time is because we're a decimal world, right? A non-decimal world wouldn't take as long, most likely. Right, and you got to make all kinds of assumptions. But it, again, it's just, you know, long, long, long time ago that they got into light and life. So they're deep, deep, deep into light and life now. Okay.
Here's a quick question. I know you went over this, but... Roger's wondering, how close will our maximum evolutionary progress be to our beginning branch existence? And of course, don't maximum progress.
Right. I mean, again, that bit about, you know, remember when a world is deeply settled in light and life, I mean, those mortals are learning the super universe tongue, you know, and stuff. I mean, you know, as first circlers, you know, before they fuse and leave, I mean, they're very advanced. They're, you know, extremely in tune with that other self, that Marantia self. That Marantia self, you know, can be making a lot of progress with Moda and all that sort of stuff when they're still on their nativity sphere. I mean, that's why they can skip all of the stuff in the local universe, basically, you know, when they die. They're doing everything you do at the local system and the constellation level on their nativity world. You know, and they're doing it in, say, 500 years' time. You know, they're living like 500 years or something. Yeah,
fusing, you know, regularly.
Unless, of course, they fused, you know, a lot before that. But
yeah, it's extraordinary to think about. I mean, obviously, I mean, Nevadon is one of the newer universes. And right. some of the older universes in this super universe.
Right.
Good Lord, how advanced.
Right, you have local universes that are deeply settled in light and life. You know, they're totally working with the unqualified supervisors of the Supreme.
Wow.
You know, the whole local universe, every planet is long settled in the seventh stage of light and life. And, you know. Yeah.
You know, it's challenging for me to, because I naturally have an upside down vision of light and life. The word settled indicates to me that it's not dynamic.
Yeah.
That it's And the truth of it is it's more dynamic. There's more going on. It's more.
Right. Again, the first paragraph we read here, when to say a world is settled in light and life is to say that it's settled in a full beginning for an inhabited world. Right? Everything is a beginning. Right? I mean, everything will really be a beginning in the grand universe until one day a beginning is followed by the ending for everyone, right? Remember, the entire grand universe, you know, is lifted up into an absentite phenomenon all at once, the last step.
And the appearance of the Supreme.
Right, and then, you know, and then everything is absentite, and, well, you know, then you finally can see the Supreme. The Supreme Being is already in existence as an absentite being right now. I mean, if he wasn't, how could he have deputies? You know, that are down working with finaliters in local universes that are deeply settled in light and life and stuff like that.
You know, I just had another thought when you said about we have to learn.
Go ahead.
Learn languages. When we get up there, we won't have our bodies and we won't have these brains. So I bet it'll be a hell of a lot easier to learn a language when we're not.
In general, yes. Yeah, remember, they do make that comment that, you know, up there you learn a language just as you do here. But to your point, you've got better equipment,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, so.
You get rid of your divisions, whether you're stupid here.
I mean, one of the problems we have learning a language here is our small capacity of mind, right?
Yeah.
Right, you know, and you will have a much bigger capacity, much more fluid, you know, teachable mind. You know, our minds tend to get pretty calcified pretty quick, and we're just hopelessly unteachable. You know, we have teachable mind in name only, right? And you can't teach old dogs new tricks. You know, we have that expression. That's because, you know, just because you have technically teachable mind doesn't mean you're very teachable. You know, after a point, right? And you don't get, you know, you don't have that problem when you've got a Marantia mind on there. It doesn't calcify like that, right? It stays ever young, you know, and ever teachable. All right, so let's get into this a little bit here.
Section 1, the planetary life. The universes of time and space are gradual in development. The progression of life, terrestrial or celestial, is neither arbitrary nor magical. Cosmic evolution may not always be understandable, predictable, but it is strictly non-accidental.
Okay, so see how, like I said, you're going to get a little bit about evolution, right? They're going to speak a little bit like we were up in the beginning of part 3 and, you know, and doing those historical geology papers. You get a little flavor of it here. You know, so they want to make that initial statement, you know, to challenge our current notions about evolution. You know, there whether it's on the materialist's side, you know, like say a staunch neo-Darwinist, where your thinking is arbitrary in some way, you know, just accidental, or, you know, on a very simplistic religionist side, you know, where you think that it's somehow magical. Right. Either extreme of the so-called scientists or the so-called religionists. Right. No. Cosmic evolution may not always be understandable, predictable, but it is strictly non-accidental. Right. Everything is very definitively encompassed by law. Right. There's rules, everything. I mean, just like we read up there, the limitation is by decree of the Ancients of Days, for instance. Right? There's a rule about how many inhabited worlds you can have in this system. I mean, everything is, there's an order to everything. You know, especially when all is said and done with the evolution of the Supreme, there are no coincidences. Right? There's nothing even remotely accidental. It's all part of one organic system. Now, that doesn't mean, like they're saying there, that even if you have a very advanced science, you can predict everything, right? It's a big, complex system, and even very advanced beings can't penetrate all of the details of the Supreme. Right? So it's not always predictable, and in that sense, understandable, like they're saying. You don't have the underlying law that allows you to predict, you know, going forward. The underlying law is too diffused into the whole, and it's inscrutable. Okay, but they wanted to make that definitive statement up front that as we get into the next section and they talk about all of these variations and all this sort of stuff, to somehow appreciate that that's all somehow a very definitively defined plan, even though it seems like it's like, well, we got this world, I don't know, what can we do with this one? You know, when all is said and done, oh, you needed a world just like that with those particular challenges, and the life carriers had to respond to those challenges in the way they did. Right? You know, when all is said and done, it all is part of an order.
Isn't that patterned?
Right.
Isn't part of the pattern?
The universe is mind-made and personality managed. Personality is spirit pattern, right? There's pattern, there's purposing imposed upon everything. Yeah. Okay, what else do they say along this lines of basic evolution?
The biologic unit of material life is the protoplasmic cell, the communal association of chemical, electrical, and other basic energies. The chemical formulas differ in each system, and the technique of living cell reproduction is slightly different in each local universe. But the life carriers are always the living catalyzers who initiate the primordial reactions of material life. They are the instigators of the energy circuits of living matter.
Okay. So two things. Giving you that interesting little tidbit that no matter how much diversity you talk about, it's all based upon what we understand a body to be based upon, cells. All these creatures in all these different worlds have cells like we do, eukaryotic cells. Right? There's a nucleus with DNA, right? And then all the machinery outside of that to produce proteins and, you know, and the mitochondria that are power plants for that, you know, that factory and all that stuff, right? That protoplasmic cells, right? So right there, you know, any sort of scientific speculation about some life on some planet that's not based upon cells, no. All life on all planets is based upon cells like we have. You know, just variations like they're saying. You have a communal association of chemical, electrical, and other basic energies, you know, and it's just varying the details. There's reproduction everywhere, you know. The details vary slightly from one local universe to the next. And notice that it's not one local system, but one local universe. So this whole bit about the patterning, a creator son imposing his personal stamp on a given local universe, that trickles all the way down to the way life carriers design the reproductive process. You know, in animals on the planets in that local universe. Slightly different because of the slightly different personality of the creator son in that local universe.
It's still a pattern.
And you should be just like, well, what does that mean? Well, of course, I don't know. As you go from local universe to local universe, when you actually can range, beyond our local universe, you'll start to be exposed to these variations. Let alone what the heck it might be like in a different super universe, right? And then that last part is a reminder. Remember what they're, getting at there, kind of poetically even, about the life carriers being the instigators, right? It's through them that the life animation is bestowed on that dead matter. And it becomes animate, living matter. And so just reminding that they're designing things, and then it's through them that both the living vitality and the reproductive spark get bestowed. So that you have living matter, like they're saying in the last two words there. All right.
That's a curious energy circuits, though.
Mm-hmm.
This life animation must not be just something that they bestow and it exists within that organism. It has to be
right. Okay, so what are the immediate energy circuits that are associated with even the most primitive living matter? What's that you know of one additional energy that's associated with even the most primitive living things?
Mind.
Yeah, what kind of mind?
Material.
Mechanical mind. Right? Mechanical mind, right, which before it's any sort of activity, mind activity, it's a particular type of mind energy, right? And remember there's 10 forms of physical energy, 9 dead, 3 living energies. That energy of mechanical mind is one of those living energies, right? Those energy circuits, is the primary thing they want you to think about there. I mean, as soon as they bestow life animation on it, that animated matter, that living matter, gets encircuited in the mechanical mind by the master physical controllers. Right? It's encircuited. Every animated blob of matter is encircuited in those energy circuits. Not to mention all sorts of other things that we couldn't understand. But that's the immediate one that you can understand of why they're saying energy circuits, because it's mechanical mind energy that's encircuited in all living matter.
And they're all within the mind of our created Mother Spirit, right?
Right. It's not her immediate mind until it's an animal, right? It has agent mind. Before that, it's just the mechanical controllers and the mechanical mind that they're ministering.
Why is it that we're mortal? I mean, because these prokaryotic cells mm-hmm. are essentially immortal.
Right. I mean, the basic reason is when you have we have cellular differentiation like we do, and life animation identified with that multicellular organism. The engagement of that life animation degrades with time. So eventually that life animation isn't identified with that matter anymore, and so that would make the matter dead matter. Right?
Why is it degrade?
We don't know. Not even the revelators understand the physics of life animation, but it just does. It's just an empirical fact that beings on high understand all the details of, but you know, no one understands. I mean, that's one of the deep mysteries, is how life animation is identified with dead matter. I mean, it's the same mystery, really, as why personality would identify with me or you. Right? It's the same very, you know, life animation is not a, you want to think about that as an object. Right? It's not matter or mind or spirit or, you know, just like personality isn't any of those things. Right? It's this very mysterious influence that's engaging. And one of the mysteries is that that engagement is temporal, you know, and isn't constant with time for some things that it engages. Yeah. You know, it sticks with a giant tortoise longer than it sticks with you.
Says a lot for you.
Or you.
Should I slow down?
All right.
All the worlds of a local system disclose unmistakable physical kinship. Nevertheless, each planet has its own scale of life, no two worlds being exactly alike in plant and animal endowment. These planetary variations in the system life types result from the decisions of the life carriers. But these beings are neither capricious nor whimsical. The universes are conducted in accordance with law and order. The laws of Nebadon are the divine mandates of Salvington, and the evolutionary order of life in Satania is in consonance with the evolutionary pattern of Nebadon.
All right, so, you know, we talked about that back in the paper about the life carriers, you know, what a challenge that is for humans to come to terms with how removed God the Father is from actual, you know, starting up life on a world. And, you know, it's basically in the hands of the life carriers. But it's not capricious or whimsical. They're working in a certain set of pre-constraints. You know, they have to know they're in the local universe of Nebadon, for instance, or they have to know that they're in the system of Satania, you know, and there's boundaries. But, you know, they're just given some basic boundaries, and then they can do whatever they creatively come up with within those boundaries. They can exercise their personality and be creative. It's like, okay, within these boundaries, given this world, design something that can live there. Well, let's see. Can I come up with a scheme, right, that stays within these boundaries and yet, you know, can make it on that world? And they're very clever. They come up with all sorts of clever variations within their boundaries.
How do they work the decimal worlds?
Right, and then on the decimal worlds, right, remember they have even fewer constraints than they normally do. They have the minimum of constraints. They have much more, options in play than they normally do. So it's like, well, let's try it like this. You know, and again, saying try it like this is not, you know, just for the fun of it. No, it's not whimsical. You know, neither is it capricious. It's not like just, well, I don't know. I was drinking last night, and you know, I woke up this morning, and I had this weird thought in my head, and so I just did it. No, no.
The hangover reminded me of how I should design.
But there's always bail, so don't worry.
It's not like people tweeting, you know, when they're drinking, right? And then they regret what they tweet. Right? It's not capricious. Right? And even though that's all, they're trying to get you to, you know, we have lots of science fiction stories. I mean, think about how this is relevant is. You have lots of science fiction stories that life, you know, is whimsical or capricious. You know, and there's just, you know, there isn't any God. There's just really, really high beings, you know, and they're playing marbles or something, right? You know, really. You know, you think it's all a profound life, you know, and there's a God and life has meaning and all this sort of stuff, you know, and then the science fiction story zooms out and says, no, it's just a bunch of goofy, you know, bizarre aliens playing marbles.
Chaos
or something,
craziness.
Right? Right? No, it's not like that.
Well, you know, made us the way we are in human form, you know, with our heads and our arms and our legs and our bodies and our faces and so forth. And then you have an accident of some kind, and mm-hmm. you get an elephant man, for instance. You know, how does that happen when they... It's just some kind of a thing because they didn't get it all...
No, the reason that you can get very unfortunate individuals... you know, that are not normal, not, you know, not able to function normally, is fundamentally because it's living matter. Unlike dead matter, living matter has variability. Living matter, because of its design and because of the addition of life animation, has variability. A living, you know, living matter can has a lot of options, again, in its manifestation. I mean, think about some creatures. Yeah. You know, how much they can vary their appearance. Is their genetics changing? No, they have the exact same genetics. They can radically transform the way they appear.
Yeah.
Change color, change shape, you know, whatnot.
Darwinism.
Right? You know, and that difference, you know, that's because living matter has variability, right? And so there's no escaping that. You need variability so that, you know, in a very general sense, so that you can have the potential to be creative, right? How could you ever be creative if you had no variability, right? If you were just a fixed phenomenon, you know, can a typewriter by itself be creative? No. Yeah, but you can, you know, let alone a rock. Can a rock be creative? No, it's not variable. It's just a rock. It stays the same. So that fundamental fact that you need to ultimately be creative means you have to, at the foundation, be variable. You have to have the potential of variability. But just like they say with creativity, you can't give a creature creativity without giving him an equal potential for destructivity. Right? So you can't give living matter the potential to be able to vary to a positive expression without it also having the potential to vary to a very unfortunate negative expression. You can't have one without the other. Right? So, when it's not over-controlled well, it can go off in a very negative way, whether it's the matter going off in a negative way because it's not properly over-controlled by mind, or it's the mind going off in a very negative way because it's not over-controlled by spirit, or the spirit going off in a very negative way because it's not over-controlled by personality. All right, and then... So let's see, that paragraph there. So let's see, what else did we have there? We had, the thing at the beginning. I knew there was something else I wanted to say. All the worlds of a local system disclose unmistakable physical kinship without knowing, you know, having to know anything about the physics of designing life or anything like that, or what the big plan is about local systems related to Havona worlds or anything like that. What's the thing that you know? They may be bipedal. But what's the thing you know about why, say, they're all bipedal? You know, why are all the worlds of a local system unmistakably, you know, similar? You know some reason why that has to be. Why can't the worlds in a local system vary, have a lot of variability, have a very extreme variability?
Because they're tied to Havana.
No. More closer to home.
Another spirit?
Okay. Eventually, every world has to have biologic...
Adam and Eve.
Yes, Adam and Eve.
They have to be able to mate with
them. Come on, we've said that many, many times. Keep the big picture in your mind here, right? I mean, there's only one type of material sons and daughters in a local system. You don't have 1,000 different types of material sons and daughters for 1,000 different worlds. You got one type of material son and daughter with one type of DNA. They have to be able to mate, their children anyway, with... every, you know, will creature on every of those roughly 1,000 worlds, right? So they can't be too variable,
But there's different kinds of material sons and daughters in different
local systems, right? Wow. Right? Right? And, you know, we couldn't mate with a material son and daughter from another local system. We're not biologically compatible. Right? But the children of a given Adam and Eve in a local system can mate with all of these different variables that we're about to read about. Right? Because they have to be biologically uplifted. Okay, so that's, you know, when you like you said, you should be always asking why and see if you can answer the why question. Why would there be unmistakable physical kinship? Well, for no other reason, because of material sons and daughters. Okay? It's got to be at least one reason why. All right. And just stressing it in the middle there, even though we kind of basically said it, you know, but just these planetary variations in the system life types result from the decisions of the life carriers. They're just creatures, right? Not even remotely gods, the life carriers. They're just creatures, right? And it's in their hands, their decisions. You know, the kind of, we talked about that in the life carrier paper, the kind of trust that is involved in the delegation, right? The father doesn't need to be hands-on with the creation of life. He can delegate it almost an infinite distance down from him to a life carrier. And the life carriers can do that job completely adequately. They're doing that job as mere creatures way down in the hierarchy, as if the father was doing it himself. But he doesn't do it himself, and technically he can't. Right, because if he actually stuck his fingers down in there, you know, he'd swallow the whole universe, and there wouldn't be a universe. Right, there would just be God the Infinite. Right, he has to stay out of; he can't dip his fingers into the, you know, the workings. Right, so that, you know, that alteration of the creation story, you know, if you will,
it's quite an alteration.
Right, quite an alteration. There's no immediate creators in the creation story. There's creatures with making decisions about, you know, what your wound healing mechanism is going to be. Right? And how you're going to handle temperature variations. And right. But, you know, that's why they throw in. See, I wanted you to get, you know, if that really sinks in, you go, oh, no wonder they added the latter parts of that paragraph. So you don't start hyperventilating. Thinking you're in the hands of just some creature instead of in the hands of God, right? Now, the laws of Nebadon are the divine mandates of Salvington, and the evolutionary order of life in Satania is in consonance with the evolutionary pattern of Nebadon. Right? So don't panic. Everything's okay. But just remember, one day you're going to have some very high responsibilities put into your hands, and it's not because you're going to be God. Right? You're just going to be another creature like life carriers are, but you're going to have awesome responsibilities put into your hands, and you're going to pull it off brilliantly. Because you won't have this little pea brain capacity like, you know, we all have right now.
That's what the life carriers gave us. You know, we're imperfect because that's what they gave us.
Enough. And they gave us just enough tension to get you going, just enough stability so that you're ongoing. But just enough off kilter to give you a challenge, right? You got to always be on the edge in order to be living. All right. Yeah, yeah, just yeah. You know, you think about, yeah, you know, it's like salmon spawning, you know, and the vicissitudes of that, you know, and you've seen, you know, notice that they mentioned that, like Gene is just saying, you know, up there, you know, in that second sentence, these spheres are the spawning ground, right? They didn't just pick that word because they thought it would be fun poetically, right? They're trying to get you to think, whoa, like the vicissitudes of salmon spawning? And yeah, right, that's the evolutionary existence. Okay.
Evolution is the rule of human development, but the process itself varies greatly on different worlds. Life is sometimes initiated in one center, sometimes in three, as it was on Urantia. On the atmospheric worlds, it usually has a marine origin. but not always. Much depends on the physical status of a planet. The life carriers have great latitude in their function of life initiation.
See, so there they say it right there, like I've been saying, you know, all those different options, like I was saying. You see, they have great latitude. It's in their hands. It's entrusted to them, solely to them, almost all of the details. And so, you know, notice they're starting to pick away a little bit. It's like, well, I know something about the evolution on this planet. I know we have an atmosphere here. I'm breathing it right now. I know that life initially was just in the oceans, and then eventually it came up on the land. And so they're saying, well, yeah, that's not uncommon, but not always, like they're saying there. See, they're starting to tease you a little bit about where we're going. Sort of validating what you're familiar with, but then encouraging you to open up to all kinds of different options. Even that bit about, we know we had single-celled plants that were put in shallow seas in three locations, right? A western, a central, and an eastern location. That's not always the case. And you're thinking, oh yeah, that might have something to do with being a decimal world and all the vicissitudes. If evolution on that world is going to be much more tightly constrained, there's not so many, whoa, didn't see that coming, sort of things that might happen. You can just have it put in one spot, and everything will just kind of start in a very sort of much more linear way instead of this, three different things and weird mixing between the three different and all that sort of stuff like we had here. All right.
In the development of planetary life, the vegetable form always precedes the animal and is quite fully developed before the animal patterns differentiate. All animal types are developed from the basic patterns of the preceding vegetable kingdom of living things. They are not separately organized.
Okay, so there's giving you just kind of these little benchmarks about, what kind of variation can you expect? It's like, well, are there worlds where there's animals that didn't come from plants? No, not in general. As a general rule, no, if you've got a normal sort of evolutionary process, I mean, who knows what the heck to make of non-breather worlds, as we'll get to later on, right? But in a normal situation, you have the life carriers are starting with single-celled plants, and a long time goes by. How long was it here? 100 million years, right? Long time goes by where all you have is plants. And finally, those plants get sophisticated enough that suddenly you can get the first animal, single-celled animal. Right? So they're saying that's the normal process. The thing that isn't so normal is to have that transition from plant to animal be so fuzzy like it was on our decimal world. Right? On a normal world, it's a pretty clean sort of, step. You don't have these kind of weird blendy sorts of, creatures like we have here. It's like, is that a plant or is that an animal? Right? You don't have that normally. You have these borderland things here because everything is all loosey-goosey on this decimal world. But you do have that basic pattern, so that life carriers have to design a plant will evolve into an animal that will evolve into the human that they want. And they've got to project that design through all those suddenlies and all the gradualies in between the suddenlies. And they have a certain will creature that they want to come out. And they've got to build that into the system from the beginning. This little single-celled algae has to end up being the will creature they want. Right? Like in our world, they wanted a pre-sangic will creature, they wanted a Nanan Infanta, so that the subtle little changes they made when they designed that first single-celled algae is what made it so that in this environment it evolved to Nanan Infanta. Yeah. I mean, it's just mind-boggling, the knowledge they have. And what's the big difference? Like we said, that energy circuits, right? It starts out, it's all mechanical mind. Plants only have mechanical mind. Suddenly you get the first animal, now you have the first adjutant. In addition, to mechanical mind. Right. Let's see. And the other thing that reminds you of is the integrity of animals is predicated on the integrity of plants. Right? And the integrity of humans is predicated on the integrity of animals. Again, it's just like that first passage where they're telling you about how everything is a means to the next end, right? There's always a beginning. Or even up there, what was that, two paragraphs back? Remember how they said each planet has its own scale of life? Did you think about what the word scale meant there? Right, there's a hierarchy, right? Levels, like tick marks on a scale, right? There's a ladder that you scale. When you say you scale a ladder, right? Right. So every world has that hierarchy, and each level rests upon the integrity of the level below. And it's all fundamentally seated upon the integrity of the vegetable life. All right.
Let's see here.
The early stages of life evolution are not altogether in conformity with your present-day views. Mortal man is not an evolutionary accident. There is a precise system, a universal law, which determines the unfolding of the planetary life plan on the spheres of space. Time and the production of large numbers of a species are not the controlling influences. Mice reproduce much more rapidly than elephants, yet elephants evolve more rapidly than mice.
So now they're just making a little passing statement about these false assumptions that that current materialistic evolutionists make. It's not an evolutionary accident. It all isn't all just this random process look at there. The tornado left a washing machine behind when it went through the junkyard. All right, it's not like that. It isn't just an issue of, well, if you give it enough time and you put enough tornadoes through enough junkyards, right, you're eventually going to get a washing machine left behind. No, see, time and the production of large numbers of a species are not the controlling influences. Right, that's not how it works. It isn't just the law of large numbers. Where even though it's a 0.0000, a million zeros and a 1%, right, that it happens, you give it enough time and enough numbers and you'll get at least one. No, that's not the way it works. It's all designed, all over controlled. Right, so they want to make that statement. And they're giving you just a little, for the more scientific amongst you, they're giving you a little thought experiment. Think about the difference between mice and elephants. Right? If it's all just about lots of numbers and you get these random mutations and boy, there's all this evolution because of that, because of the large numbers. No, mice reproduce much more rapidly than elephants, yet elephants evolve more rapidly than mice. Why? Because it's not some random process, it's an over-controlled process. Things aren't evolving, they're being evolved. Right? And if nothing else, there's a lot more for that influence from above to grab a hold of with an elephant than there is with a mouse. Right? There's more to evolve with an elephant. Right?
Because elephants have family life and that kind
of thing. Elephants have all five adjutants and pretty significant, how much can it engage? How much of the fifth adjutant can you seat on this creature? If you can't seat very much, that's going to limit how much influence for it to evolve that there is. If all you can seat is the first adjutant on it, right? No wonder amoebas, when they were the first animals, a single-celled animal-like an amoeba, they haven't changed much all the way to today, right? Because you just have the little bit of the first adjutant engaging it. So that's what they're getting at. They're trying to think about how you have that over-control of evolution, mind onto matter. And the bigger footprint that mind has, the more potential there is for it to over-control it. All right, then this last little paragraph.
The process of planetary evolution is orderly and controlled. The development of higher organisms from lower groupings of life is not accidental. Sometimes evolutionary progress is temporarily delayed by the destruction of certain favorable lines of life plasm carried in a selected species. It often requires ages upon ages to recoup the damage occasioned by the loss of a single superior strain of human heredity. These selected and superior strains of living protoplasm should be jealously and intelligently guarded when once they make their appearance. And on most of the inhabited worlds, these superior potentials of life are valued much more highly than on Urantia.
Ah, so they end with a very politically incorrect note. Right, so, I mean, start with the first part of that paragraph. You know, just recognizing that because it's evolution isn't something that's bubbling up from the bottom, it's being imposed from the top down. Things are being evolved through the over-control of mind over matter. You know, and the higher you go up, the bigger the picture that it is. See? So a very big picture is being fed into each little individual thing that's evolving forward down at the bottom of the picture. And because of that, if, you know, a very positive line has gotten developed and something snuffs it out, right? There's a very unfortunate, earthquake or something, you know, in a particular location that kills all of that species. It's just a handful that were getting started, you know, and the life carriers go, okay, we'll be here for another couple hundred million years.
put another pot of coffee.
Yeah, put another pot of coffee on. But the fact is that they don't just give up. They put another pot of coffee on, right? Because it may take a while, but that over-control will eventually take the latent potentials, you know, and get it back to that that important step that it got it to. Remember how they talk about that with our evolution, you know, if a certain frog, you know, hadn't leapt, it's right, that sort of a thing. You know, it wouldn't have been the end, but, you know, it would have
taken, right?
Evolution would have found another path to the same end.
Tornadoes are good at that. Lightning and thunder, good at that stuff.
Okay, so, yep. All right, so that basic, you know, sort of demonstration of the over-control like that. And then the way it turns at the end, you know, it's like, well, what, you know, how this very much impacts us and our thinking about ourselves. Eugenics, right? See, they're bringing in eugenics at the end, right? And they're wanting you to think about humans, the human species like that, that if you get a superior strain that comes into existence, that's something that it took that influence from above a very long time to slowly coalesce out of all of the variables, right? And it's not going to just come around every other day. Right? It should be recognized for what it is. And because we don't do that, like you're saying, on most of the inhabited worlds, these superior potentials of life are valued much more highly than on Urantia. So that's why, right, the planetary administrators got that request to conserve some of the higher types. Remember that? Okay. You know, they wouldn't have to do that if we were, you know, more on the ball with this. If we were recognizing that we're an animal origin species subject to all of the influences of any evolutionary species. Okay.
When were they requested to preserve the higher...
conserve the higher spiritual types. Remember that? Right? Wow. You know, that passage? You know, they just mentioned that in passing, right? It's because, you know, they're trying to remind you here that You know, you can't, remember, before there's will creatures, the life carriers are there watching for, ooh, there's a very positive strain, and they actually do things to protect that strain. You know, they don't just throw it in the deep end and hope it survives. You know, they tweak things a little bit, right? But as soon as they're will creatures, right, it doesn't mean that there isn't still a need for personal management. Right? They were persons that were managing. When there's will creatures, we're supposed to take that over. So that's what they're challenging there. Universe is mind made and personality managed. Even though you didn't have a lot to do with the making of it, doesn't mean you don't have a lot to do with the personal management of it.
Oftentimes we go in the directly opposite direction.
All right, and if you get some silly notion in your head that is actually 180 degrees, right, there can be an emergency on a planet that gets them to write a vast text like the Urantia book and send it to that world. Right? If there is so little wisdom in play.
That's another little issue we need to work on.
If you imagine everyone has equal capacity, yeah, and that all schools should perform alike, which is common thought these days.
Yeah. Right. I mean, does this paragraph really support the human belief that all men are born equal?
No.
No. They may be all created equal, but they're not all born equal. There are superior strains of human heredity. Right? Yeah. We all know we're not allowed to even think such thoughts anymore.
Not PC.
Not politically correct. Okay. All right. Now, you know, this next section is very long. We're not obviously not going to get all the way through it. But why don't, you know, we've got another 15 minutes here. Why don't we get into it a little bit and maybe get a subsection or two here.
Then we'll find out what the atmospheric folk are.
Yep.
Section 2, planetary physical types. There is a standard and basic pattern of vegetable and animal life in each system, but the life carriers are oftentimes confronted with the necessity of modifying these basic patterns to conform to the varying physical conditions which confront them on numerous worlds of space. They foster a generalized system type of mortal creature. But there are 7 distinct physical types, as well as thousands upon thousands of minor variants of these 7 outstanding differentiations. 1, atmospheric types. 2, elemental types. 3, gravity types. 4, temperature types. 5, electric types. 6, energizing types. 7, unnamed types. The Satania system contains all of these types and numerous intermediate groups, although some are very sparingly represented.
Okay, so that last little statement, just reminding, they're not giving you all the details, they're not allowed to, if nothing else. Just giving you a little thumbnail sketch. but it is interesting to note that even as small a sample as just 619 worlds, you know, out of billions and billions and, you know, of worlds in the universe of universes, you span, you know, the spectrum of these variations. You know, so yeah, that's an interesting thing to know, that even as, you know, a limited a region in the Milky Way galaxy as our little, you know, local system occupies, there is enough variation of environment and world types that, you know, they need to be, you know, modifying all over in these, you know, in these, this, throughout this spectrum of different types.
Could this be a decimal universe?
No. Right. I mean, you don't have quote-unquote decimal universes. And I'm saying you don't have quote-unquote decimal universes. It's not like every tenth universe, right? But you do have experimental universes.
That's what I was talking about.
Every universe is an experimental universe, right? Every single universe is an experimental universe. Why? Because there's those. Why would each one be an experiment unto itself?
Because the mothers are different.
How come? Now, the mothers are all the same to begin with in a super universe.
Because there's the, what's the word?
That's the one. The,
what's different about every local universe fundamentally?
There's a different flavor.
Right, why is there a different flavor?
Yeah.
Different creator son, right? We already pointed that out. Every local universe has a unique person overseeing it, imposing his unique pattern upon it, right? Every local universe is an experiment of what happens when this pattern is imposed upon a local universe. Let's see. No one knows in advance. In the same mode, why is it a universe of universes? Why isn't it just a universe? Why is it a nation of states instead of just one state? Why aren't we just a territorial state? Why are we a collection of states? Each state is a...
experiment.
Yeah, an experiment. A laboratory for democracy, right? Right. The United States is a collection of states for the same reason that the universe is a collection of universes. Every state is an experiment. Every local universe is an experiment. That's another way that the United States embodies what's on high down below. Right? And so efforts that have led to the emergency that's sitting in my lap, the response to the emergency that's sitting in my lap. I mean, one of those things is efforts to destatize, right, the United States and just, not make it a federal system, but to make it just a national system where every state is identical. No, that's counter to one of the most fundamental truths of reality, that it's a universe of universes, not just a universe. Right? That's how deeply off track we are, that we're thinking that's what we should do.
Right.
Is in a totalitarian way, erase the boundaries. Right? Okay, so just think about how this stuff has very profound significance. Okay? Let's see. And I'll just say it again. In the middle of that beginning paragraph before the list of seven, it says, they, the life carriers, foster a generalized system type of mortal creature. Why?
Because the
material sons and daughters are of one type. Yes, yeah, so just trying to see if you could get it the second time around. Right? Right? There's a sentence. You ask why. If you can't answer the why question, at least read again. But recognize you're not making any progress with the fifth epical revelation if you can't answer any why question.
Right?
You need to ask yourself, why exactly am I reading this thing if I haven't learned anything? If I can't answer a single why question?
You have to learn how to read it.
Yeah. The important question is why, not who, what, where, when, Not those factual questions. Can you answer a why question? Mm-hmm. Right? And if you believe it's a sacred text, that would be blasphemy to ask why. Right? No. Ask why. Figure it out. Universe is logical. If you can answer a why question, you've started to use your first cosmic intuition. You've started to take delight in cultivating. Right? All right. So, yeah, we probably have just enough time, I bet, for the atmospheric types here.
One, the atmospheric types. The physical differences of the worlds of mortal habitation are chiefly determined by the nature of the atmosphere. Other influences which contribute to the planetary differentiation of life are relatively minor. The present atmospheric status of Urantia is almost ideal for the support of the breathing type of man, but the human type can be so modified that it can live on both the super atmospheric and the sub atmospheric planets. Such modifications also extend to the animal life, which differs greatly on the various inhabited spheres. There is a very great modification of animal orders on both the sub and the super atmospheric worlds.
Okay, so let's start with that first little paragraph. Okay, so you know, just initially they want you to think about kind of the physical variations that are sort of within your realm of imagination. Like you can imagine, well, there could be a world where there's a much lower ratio of land to water than we have here, for instance, or a much higher ratio of land to water, you know, or you know, there's a lot more high elevation than we have, or, you know, maybe there's almost no high elevations at all, or there's a lot more deserts than we have, or, you know, whatever you might think of like that. They're saying all those sorts of variations, you know, are relatively minor. The really big issue is what kind of an atmosphere it has. Is it low density, high density, or somewhere in the middle? But that's the really big issue that the life carriers are dealing with. So that's telling you something very fundamental about the relationship of life to the environment, right? That's the biggie in terms of the relationship of life to the environment, is your relationship between you and the atmosphere, less than your relationship to other physical things. How many mountains there are, how many deserts there are, how much ocean there is, you know, or what have you. That's the really big thing. So that's kind of interesting. You know, we don't understand the physics enough to fully appreciate that, but they at least gave you that little hint. Saying that the present atmospheric status of your ranch is almost ideal. Well, what if you had an ideology where you believed the current state of the atmosphere was ideal? And you turned this into a whole religion. And if you saw any sign that of the atmosphere changing, you start hyperventilating and want to mount a vast political movement to stop the atmosphere from varying.
Stop human progress.
Right. So think about, okay, first of all, just the simple fact unto itself that the atmosphere is not currently ideal. So you're preventing progress toward a more ideal atmosphere, perhaps. Perhaps not. I mean, how do you know? Do you have the vast wisdom to know what the ideal state of the atmosphere is relative to our type of biology? Right. And then just on top of what the little thing Gene threw in there, I mean, the fact that the atmosphere is very fundamentally tied to humanity, of all the physical things, they're saying it's one that's really foundationally tied. If humans are going to progress, the atmosphere has to progress because we're coupled with it. So to prevent change of the atmosphere might be preventing change of humanity towards that light and life state that you'd love to have with your spiritual consciousness. Look at what's in play, right? Look at how unhumble we are. Right? How certain we are. We know what is ideal. Right? I mean, I'm not saying that there may not be issues. I like the fact that I can breathe the air in this room, you know, and we haven't polluted this air in this room so much I can't breathe it. That's handy. Right? Right? But right, when you turn it into, when you absolutize your subjective understanding of this, right, and turn it into this religious phenomenon.
Yeah, we are the proverbial flea on the elephant's fanny.
Okay, so just notice how, that has a very immediate consequence. Just those subtle little statements. It's almost like they knew we would get wrapped around the axle in a few decades in this way. So they reminded you of that right here, right? This is a long time before anyone was worried about global cooling or global warming or climate change or anything, right?
this must be something that's universal. On every planet, there must be this concern about the change in the atmosphere.
Especially if you don't have any planetary administrators that you're talking to that keep in the straight and narrow a little bit more instead of going off on these tangents, these ideology tangents, ideological tangents. Okay, so then the other thing there is, you know, that they're going to tell us about something that is, you know, like I was saying, a higher density, super atmospheric, or a much lower density, sub-atmospheric. That's what they mean by those. They don't mean literally atmospheres that are higher in elevation or lower in elevation or something, right? I mean, what does above and below you know, mean there, super and sub? Higher density or lower density? And again, remember we're reading about how human life is predicated on an animal life. So if the will creatures are going to be very different relative to this atmosphere, you know, that's predicated on the animals being very different relative to that atmosphere. So you could have not just a vast diversity of will creatures, but you're going to have a vast diversity of animals too. You know, maybe by the time you get down to plants, maybe plants are a lot more general. You know, just notice that they're giving you that little hint. Don't expect to find similar animals here on a world where the will creatures are really different from here. No, the animals have to be very different too. Okay? You can't get a really different human from very similar animals. Okay? Doesn't work that way. All right.
Of the atmospheric types in Cetania, about 2.5% are subbreathers, about 5% superbreathers, and over 91% are midbreathers, altogether accounting for 98.5% of the Cetania worlds.
Okay. And we'll get to the rest of that in a minute here, but. Okay, so, all right, so you got some facts there. What's the big picture there? That this, when you're talking about atmospheric types, it looks like it's very bell curve-y here, right? Is a huge bias to mid-breathers, right? By and large, inhabited worlds are mid-breather worlds. Super-breather, sub-breather is a... you know, as an exception to a rule, right? So, again, the fact that it's so definitive, I mean, you know, over 91% are mid-breathers. And this whole bit about, they said that the atmosphere was such a significant element. You know, what that's telling you about how that very significant element has a very solid center to it. You really can't stray too far from that core. You know, you do it as a very much an exception to the rule. That they have limited ability to do things off that center. Okay, so that's the key here. You'll see in other variations, other types are going to give us. It isn't so, you know, definitively, you know, centralized like that. There, you know, there's a much broader spectrum, and it's distributed more uniformly. Right? It isn't so centrally biased like that. Okay, so that's an interesting point again. To somehow, the atmosphere thing is very significant. You know, so it's kind of fascinating that we're so fixated on the atmosphere right now. All right.
Which is which, super breather and sub breather with. High density and low density.
Sub breathers, low density. Super breathers, high density.
So if you have low density, you need a much more.
Well, you'll see that it's not as simple as, you know, I've got to breathe faster or something like that. I mean, I'll give you a little tease here. You know, sub breathers, for instance, need help. For their energy input from master physical controllers. Things like that. You know, this is a very complicated thing. Okay, so it isn't just as simple as, well, I got to design the lungs differently or something like that. It's not as simple as that. It reminds you of just how inscrutably important this issue of atmosphere is. Okay.
Beings such as the Urantia races are classified as mid-breathers. You represent the average or typical breathing order of mortal existence. If intelligent creatures should exist on a planet with an atmosphere similar to that of your near neighbor, Venus, they would belong to the super breather group, while those inhabiting a planet with an atmosphere as thin as that of your outer neighbor, Mars, would be denominated subbreathers.
See, so that is a reminder, it's just how handy it is. It just coincidentally, our solar system, our two neighbors, one on the inside and one on the outside, have a much denser atmosphere and a much thinner atmosphere. So they can just point to those. You know, it's like, well, how thick is thick? It's like, well, okay, the atmosphere of Venus is very thick relative to the atmosphere of the Earth. And you all know the atmosphere of Mars is very thin relative to the atmosphere of the Earth. Right, so that's, they can point to those examples that we know a lot about, especially now, you know, not so much way back at the beginning of the 20th century, but especially now, we really appreciate what they're saying there to us. It's like, oh, wow. So, you know, if Venus's atmosphere didn't have the issues that it does, you could actually have an atmosphere that dense. And the life carriers can work with that, you know, or as thin as Mars. So it gives you an idea of just how clever they are, how much latitude they have to work in. You know, Venus has lots of other issues, you know. But they're pointing out, you know, the main problem with Venus is not the atmosphere being really thick. They could have worked with that. It's the other things about Venus that, you know, make it so it doesn't work. So that's, you know, that's an interesting little issue. Okay, and maybe just, you know, one other little thing people often ask, you know, how do we know that Venus and Mars aren't inhabited? Right? When we look at their atmosphere is almost totally what gas?
Carbon dioxide.
Right? They're not terraformed. Right? The master physical controllers haven't come in and converted that carbon dioxide atmosphere to a nitrogen-oxygen atmosphere. Right? That's how you know that even though the density is like super breather, sub breather, there aren't actually super breathers on Venus or sub breathers on Mars, right? Yeah. They haven't been terraformed. They're just in their, you know, natural physical evolutionary state, where it basically just has a carbon dioxide atmosphere.
That is so cool. Okay.
All right.
If mortals should inhabit a planet devoid of air, like your moon, they would belong to the separate order of non-breathers. This type represents a radical or extreme adjustment to the planetary environment and is separately considered. Non-breathers account for the remaining 1.5% of Cetania worlds.
Right, when we get to that section, you know, out of the 619, we just have 9. Non-breather worlds, you know, so it's just 1.5% of the 619. Coming up pretty soon. I know everyone is just can't wait to get to the non-breathers, but yeah, got to be patient, breathe slowly.
Or don't breathe at all.
Everyone caught the pun? We're reading about atmospheric tides? Yeah. Okay. You know, so and notice again, you know, it's handy that we've got a moon, you know, without an atmosphere, so they can, you know, they can point to very immediate objects and give you an example. But again, you go, wow, how different would life be,
really?
You know, if, you know, our moon was inhabited, you know, there's no atmosphere, there's no water, right? And the fact that you have to have animals too, when up there when it says there is a very great modification of animal orders on both the sub and the super atmospheric worlds. Whoa, think about the non-breather worlds. You know, that would give a whole new definition to very great modification.
Really,
I mean, how do you have animals? You know, just think about how confusing this is. How do you have animals on a world with, you know, I mean, see how different animals would be. You know, we think of animals as like, well, have herbivores and they go over here to a pond and drink some water and they go over here and munch on some grass. It's like, well, there's no water and there's no grass. And how does that work? You know, you can't give a horse some oats. There aren't oats. Right? And again, the non-breathers, remember we talked about this before. the non-breathers are very dependent upon the master physical controllers for energy input. They're fed directly by the master physical controllers pumping energy into them.
Interesting.
Okay.
They're probably not fat then.
Yes, the whole issue of gluttony takes on a very different perspective, right? If you're not eating. Right, so the so-called sin of gluttony might not be very prevalent on a non-breather world.
Experiential deprivation.
Okay, so anyway, not to belabor that, we'll get to delight in non-breathers in a while. But anyway, so that gets us started. So next time we'll go through some of the other types. But in many ways, you know, as you look back after we go through all these different types, you know, the atmospheric type is really intriguing. And it harkens back to what they said at the beginning there, that, you know, of all the physical differences, that's the biggie. And so it's kind of fascinating, even though we don't understand the physics of that, that you even experientially come out of this section having a tendency to remember a lot about the different and breather types rather than a lot about the different temperature types, say, or something. All right, so just, I'm just trying to encourage, you know, as much reflection as you can get out of a paragraph, out of a section like this. You know, you read the whole thing, reflect back on how you related to it, and what does that say? Why did you feel a greater affinity towards one section, one part of the section than another part? And that's the kind of active relationship that you want to cultivate. You're asking why all the time. You're really reflecting on your experience with what you're reading. Try to get that sort of relationship going, even when it seems like, oh, this is just a bunch of stuff that only scientists would be interested in, and I should skip forward to another paper here or something. You know, especially if you get a feeling like that, you know, don't let that instinct go. You know, the way it wants to go. You know, take control of your mind and challenge it to be present with something that is not immediately intriguing. And see if you can get a new experience. You know, if you never expose yourself to something that's kind of different, don't be surprised if you die in the same mentality as you were born.
This is very different.
You got to have the courage to be present with some different things long enough for something to happen. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.